Okay, back to our main topic today, and that's our ethics professors in the case of Jennifer Lawrence's stolen photographs, Ferguson, and college sexual assault. The ethics professors are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. Wayne, always good to have you. Good morning.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Clancy Martin's also back. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Clancy, good to have you.
Thanks so much for
having us,
Steve.
Are you still the chair? Am I jumping you there?
No, I have resigned as chair.
You resigned as chair. We got the record straight here. Okay. Well, Jennifer Lawrence is a big movie star and an Oscar winner. Has she been victimized here in this case involving nude photographs of herself that have been stolen off iCloud, I guess? Or has she, in a sense, victimized herself, Wayne Vaught? How do you size this one up?
I think she's clearly been victimized. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, somebody's broken into a private phone, hacked into her phone, been able, not just her, but a number of celebrities gotten access to their private photos and then exposed those photos. So there's no question about her being the victim. Now, the question is, has she exposed herself by her own actions to some of this? And clearly she has. But then you have to get into the question of, well, I mean, we all, by living, doing various things, expose ourselves to certain types of risks. And was the risk that she was taking by taking nude photos of herself or anyone taking, sharing nude photos of themselves, doing things that are inappropriate? And I think that this, you know, some probably would argue that, you know, it's ethically dubious. Why were they doing that in the first place? But this is a private matter of her doing something that obviously was enjoyable for her for whatever reason, and somebody going and digging into her private life or private files and then exposing those in a way. Then if they were personal love letters, if they were any, you know, we could imagine any sort of document that any of us that might have that we think is very personal and we wouldn't want it exposed. And, you know, for most of it, that's probably not a real issue because nobody cares about the love letters that, you know, Steve Kresge's love letters, I think, that the world would be interested in.
But, and I'll have a statement after the show today about my own new
about
photographs.
About your own photographs.
Yeah,
right.
We'll go there later on and talk about that. Yeah. I mean, Clancy Martin, is this a case? Is this akin to somebody leaving an iPhone and five $100 bills sitting on the front seat of their car, windows down, doors unlocked? Is it that kind of thing we're talking about here?
Well, it's an interesting way you pose the question, Steve. I mean, on the one hand, this is nothing new. Right. We I think it was Jackie Onassis who has published in the pages nude photographs and pages of Hustler magazine years and years ago. And celebrities in particular having photos obtained of them through dubious means that look like in one way or another violated their privacy is something that we have – is a long tradition in our culture. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing terribly shocking about that. And then there's this interesting question that you raise about, well, if we're driving a Mercedes and we leave our windows down and we leave our $500 and our iPhone sitting on the car, at some level, all of us – if we are rational, do not expect that we'll come back to our car, if our car is even still there, and find that $500 and the iPhone.
Yeah.
So I think you make a very nice point. And I think that any celebrity who puts nude photographs of himself or herself out into cyberspace these days should not be terribly shocked when suddenly they appear in the public sphere. I mean, we all know, I don't know how many times just in the past 2 years I've had to cut up my credit cards because some hacker has managed to get a hold of my credit card information, but at least two or three times I've had to do it in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, at some level, hey, what's the big surprise? Now, the other point, the points that Wayne were making, that was she wronged? Clearly. Was her privacy violated in a morally blameworthy way? Clearly, unequivocally. But the deeper point that Wayne was gesturing to is that we ought to be asking ourselves, and you know, we often talk about on this show how new technologies and the fact that technology can move a lot faster than the law and can move a lot faster than our own ability right. to kind of process how we ought to be dealing with these technologies and the way they interact with our lives, open up these maybe old, familiar moral problems, but make them more and more difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
And this is just a classic case in which, once more, technological advance, in this particular instance, it looks like possibly the iCloud, although we don't know for sure, has reopened an old moral dilemma, the dilemma of privacy, which reaches into all different dimensions of our lives.
Yeah.
So maybe the real question we ought to be asking ourselves, and that I repeat perhaps ad nauseum, is the degree of suspicion with which we treat new technologies mm-hmm. and the way we incorporate them into our lifestyles.
Let me do this. Let me get our listeners to chime in here. Is Jennifer Lawrence a victim here as we talk about her stolen photographs, or has she victimized herself? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, Wayne Vaught, we're sitting here, you know, talking about whether Jennifer Lawrence should be blamed for this or not. Maybe another question is, what about us? You know, or at least so many folks who look at this stuff, what responsibility do these folks bear who go online and then sort of complete the act of invading Jennifer Lawrence's privacy by viewing these photographs online?
Mm-hmm. And seeking them out
and
looking
them out.
For,
right. Yeah.
For those opportunities. I think that there was some headlines on the internet to that very thing, that if you're looking, if you're going, if you're clicking on these videos or these images, that you are in fact victimizing her and repeatedly victimizing her.
Exactly.
And it's the same argument you'll see with child pornography types of cases as well, where you have people who are seeking it out and using it, and the claim is, well, you're now continuing to victimize that person who was taken advantage of. And I think that there is some public responsibility because the reason that these images are as fascinating as there are is because there is a market of people who want to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And if that market were not there, then the hacker would have no basis other than his own or her own particular perversions for wanting to go in and do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a communal process, and I think people have to realize that in some way the public, by seeking out or actively going to look for these images, and particularly where there are potentials for those images to receive compensation, so you sell them to a journal or a magazine or something like that, that gets you are now, I think, a participant in the victimization of someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but come on, fellas. I mean, this is I'd like to
unrealistic.
Slightly disagree with Wayne about the analogy, although I see his point with child pornography. Jennifer Lawrence is a movie star and one of the most popular public celebrities that we have.
But now, Jennifer Lawrence didn't want Clancy
absolutely.
Martin or Steve Kresge to look at these photographs.
No, and I'll say for apparently. The record, I haven't seen them. But
yeah,
but the fact is that why I don't like the analogy with child pornography is just that in child pornography, you have someone who in no way is making themselves an object of public curiosity. That the child pornography case is straightforward victimization at every level. Jennifer Lawrence makes her living as a celebrity. Jennifer Lawrence has to deal with paparazzi every day.
Yeah, but
that's
she
part
had,
of her job.
But again, she had absolutely no intention, from what I understand. You know, and maybe she did. There's some plot here to gain publicity for.
I'm sure that's not the case.
Yeah, but she had no intention of anyone seeing this.
I agree that her privacy has been violated. I agree that people who go and look at the images, if they are on the one hand saying Jennifer Lawrence's privacy has been violated, and then on the next hand they go and look at the images, they're being moral hypocrites.
Yeah.
I agree with all of that. I'm just saying that we should also bear in mind that the fact that she is a worldwide celebrity at some level should be taken into account when we're thinking about the fact that naturally there's going to be a market for these photographs.
So you're saying it mitigates the level of outrage that she might be able to express about this?
I think so. And I'm also saying that we can't be too quick to point our fingers at people who are looking at the images so long as they are not saying, yes, and her privacy was violated, in which case I think they'd be engaged in a piece of moral hypocrisy. Because, you know, at some level, once you become a celebrity, you are just opening up your life to the fact of paparazzi, to the fact that every detail of your public life is going to be exposed in just the same way that politicians go through this kind of very, very unpleasant process. Her privacy was violated.
Although I would still argue there are limits. There's a limit for the President of the United States. There's a limit for Jennifer Lawrence.
I agree. I agree with all of that. I'm just saying the fact she's a celebrity does have a mitigating influence.
Let's go to some phone calls. JP from Ottawa, we're talking about Jennifer Lawrence's stolen photographs with our ethics professors. JP, good morning.
Good morning. And I can't believe what I was hearing from the previous speaker. She had an expectation of privacy. She did not leave the windows down with $500. She was not at a cafe or on a beach, nude beach, whatever. She was in her house doing something that she thought would be discreetly placed away. Just as if you were to place a document, a love letter, in your desk at work. You put it away, you expect privacy. And Angela Merkel, it doesn't matter who they are. She was doing something that she indeed thought was private. Somebody did something wrong to get access to those. It wasn't like you were walking down and you see somebody crawl out of a limousine and you get an oopsie shot. You dig what I'm saying? She had the greatest expectation of privacy. Somebody did a crime. There's no other way to get those images and then release those to the public. She's a big girl. She's going to handle herself. But she was wrong.
Gotcha, JP.
Jennifer Aniston. Okay.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for the phone call. Clancy, you want to respond?
I don't disagree. I mean, I agree with everything that the caller said. I was just objecting to the analogy with child pornography, which I don't think is appropriate because I do think we have to recognize that we're in a very different arena of so-called victimization once we're talking about celebrity nude photographs.
Let's go to Mike from Waldo. Mike, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. My question is, you guys are, especially the caller before, he's given her a hell of a lot more innocence than I attribute to her. And my question is, why were they sitting out there? I mean, you know, and all we got to do is walk through the checkout counter at a grocery store and see all the crap that's on the front pages of all the trash magazine. So anyways, I'm not condemning her. I'm just saying you're trying to, that's like finding the nude photo of her down in Crown Center and then saying, oh, who exposed all this? Well, I mean, you've left it in a very exposed and annoying exposed area.
Mike, I appreciate that. Maybe the question, Wayne Vaught, is this idea that if you put something on the cloud, how reasonable is your expectation of privacy? And again, some of this stuff is sort of new to me, too, but I'm wondering about that. To me, that's not anything that would necessarily is an ironclad guarantee of privacy.
I think that is one of the problems with the technology. Now, the problem is that iCloud and the purveyors of that, I think there was an article in the Star not a few weeks ago that was talking about how impossible it was to break into the iCloud and share this with, you know, I think what's the movie, the movie about the sex tapes, I think it is.
Oh, okay, sex tape, yeah.
And it gets on the iCloud, and it's now out. It's sort of a similar thing.
Yeah.
There are clear limitations to the technology, and people have to realize that if you're using this technology in the way, there is this potential risk. I don't think that mitigates the fact that if someone has something they believe to be private, whether it's a briefcase, a cell phone, a locker at their home, a safe at their home, there are always ways in which criminals people with criminal intent can get access to your private information. But that being said, I still think that, you know, you might realize that if I put this on iCloud, there is this potential risk that this is going to happen. But I don't think that takes anything away from the fact that someone did something that was enormously wrong, and there should be real
legal consequences. Yeah.
Absolutely, consequences for punishing those people, so that you know, if they find the people who did this, that there are real consequences that would be a discouragement from people from doing this very thing.
We get a phone call here, Kay from St. Joe. Kay, you're on Up to Date.
I've been listening. You've been talking about, because these people are celebrities, they might expect some of this, and I was just wondering, would it be different if medical records or credit card receipts had been hacked and shared publicly?
Well, it wouldn't be as big of a story, because people get very, you know, excited about the notion of nude photographs sometimes.
I think the caller's point is really on task. Take Miley Cyrus, for example, who was here in Kansas City, canceled a performance, was in the hospital, and there was some issue about why she was sick and some speculation about that. Was her medical information things that we would want to have access to or ought to have access to? There is some level of, I think, once you reach a level of public once you have a public persona, there is an interest in you. And and celebrities have to play and balance that, because they want that interest because they want people to come to their concerts. They want people to buy their merchandise. They go on and tweet and keep websites because they want people to be interested in them, because there's a financial interest in doing so. But then, you know, well, where do you draw the line? Okay, well, that's what you can be interested in, and this is what you cannot be interested in. And I do have to admit that celebrities have to play a real – it's a real balancing act for them. It's kind of, no, give me attention, don't give me attention, give me attention. But there does need to be, and I think there should be, an ethical expectation that there are certain zones of privacy that we ought not violate. And this is clearly one of them. And medical records, I think, would be another example of one that's clearly an area in which it would be horrendous if that information were exposed.
Clancy?
Well, and we're collapsing two issues in a way. One is the issue of, was she wronged? It's unquestionable that she was morally wronged. Something illegal and immoral was done, and her privacy was violated. That's absolutely non-controversial and straightforward. Mm-hmm. The other question is something about, like, was she acting in a morally prudent way? Was she thinking through her own situation? There is a virtue we call prudence, and it's a moral virtue. Try sending a risque email to Dean Vaught sometime and see if you get a response. You will not hear back from him. Mm-hmm. And that's because you only get the most careful email responses from the man on my right. He won't put anything out there in the public unless he knows it is very, very carefully thought through. And that's just being morally prudent.
Let me do one more phone call here. Matt from Baldwin City. Matt, good morning.
Hello. Hey, this is an important issue, and it has to do with Jennifer Lawrence said no. And it has to do with our level of misogyny in our society, I think. It speaks to many deep issues. Also, ain't nothing can't be hacked. I don't have anything to do with the cloud. I don't store stuff on the cloud. I don't see why anybody goes there expecting that it's really going to stay, you know, private forever. And but really, the bigger moral question is her agency. You know, she said no, and in storing things the way she did, in a way that she expected, she had a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Okay, Matt, that sounds good. Appreciate the call. We're going to leave our conversation there. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about two other topics, Ferguson and sexual assaults on college campuses. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussion about the origins of area festivals, plus our look at the man who created the Country Club Plaza, J.C. Nichols, you can listen to those at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, the latest indie documentary and foreign film showing on area screens. This hour, we're visiting with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, Clancy Martin, talking about a whole host of issues currently in the news. Let's turn to Ferguson. You know, lots of ethical questions connected with the controversies there. Here's one. What about the ethics of outsiders who went to Ferguson to speak out about what happened there and arguably wound up stirring up more dissent? I'm thinking about Al Sharpton, Wayne Vaught, and others. What about them?
Well, you know, this is controversial in sort of the similar ways to the issues we were just talking about. You have celebrity, you have somebody with a national profile coming into an area that is highlighting, I think, legitimately highlighting a real concern about racial issues in Ferguson, about the a lot of we could go through a lot of what the ethical issues are, but I think that. While on the one hand, I think that that can be a very good thing, that someone with a national profile comes in to highlight the problem. The issue really is how is that being handled? Is it being handled in a way that is productive, that is moving us forward, recognizing the dilemma?
The
statements that they're making, the way in which they might be rallying people to do certain things, is it being done constructively or is it being done in a way that's not being constructive? And I think that's an onus upon the person coming into a situation. Now, this was a horrific, obviously horrific situation, and does, I think, need some of the type of attention that it's getting. But if you're going to go into a situation, you have to go in, I think, with the mentality of I'm going to try to do something to be helpful ethically, to create good of a situation and not do something that's actually going to inflame or make things that
Did you see any of those outsiders, Al Sharpton or others, actually contributing positively to the cause? Did anyone stand out to you, Clancy?
Well, I'm really glad you asked the question in this way, Steve, because I was just talking about this last week with a good friend of mine who I consider to be a great moral exemplar. His name is Brian Zand, and he runs a megachurch out in – I myself am not a Christian, but Brian runs this first-century Christian megachurch out in St. Joe's. And we were meeting for lunch to talk about a couple of books that we'd written. And I said, Brian, what – have you been out to St. Louis? Are you going out to St. Louis? And he looked at me and he said, you know, I've been praying and praying about that. What should I do? And I finally decided that I didn't have anything constructive to add to what was going on out there. I'd just be one more voice saying, trying to calm everyone down.
Yeah.
And there were already lots of people out there doing that. And I thought, the people who were out there doing that, the pastors out there doing that, were actually doing an effective job. So I thought, if I can't add anything and I might cause harm, I just shouldn't go. And I thought, you know, that's what you like to see, because, of course, what one worries about is people going out there for the media attention, for the fact that they know they're suddenly going to be on their national profile will once again be enhanced, rather than merely actually trying to help the situation. Now, as far as I watched the sequence of events unfold, it did seem to me that the prominent speakers were mostly calling attention to a real problem we have in Missouri, which is a problem of ongoing racial injustice, inequality,
right,
socioeconomic injustice and inequality. And it's a problem we've had in this state for 200 years, I guess, or as long as the state's been in existence. And I didn't see any myself. I didn't see any particular figure who was seemed to be being inflammatory. So I thought most of what I saw, people were behaving responsibly and were just saying, hey, we really need to recognize that this is not just a case of something incredibly regrettable happening. This is part of a larger pattern of social injustice that seems to be ongoing in the state of and racial injustice that seems to be ongoing in the state of Missouri.
Well, to borrow your word, Clancy, a lot of folks thought the police were the inflammatory players in the situation in Ferguson. And one other question I wanted to raise with the two of you was this decision by the police to leave the body of Michael Brown on the street in the hours after he was shot for more than 4 hours, if you read the accounts right. I'm wondering about the responsibility, the ethics of that decision by the police, Wayne Vaught, to take that action that clearly inflamed at least some folks over there in terms of how they responded to this crisis.
Right. I think, that, again, it's motivation and the purpose behind their action. And in a situation like that, they should have responded in a way that generally was showing them being a protector of the community, of coming in. And I think that, you know, you're starting to second guess, and that's the difficulty I have.
Yes.
When you have a situation like this, your second guess motivations and what was going through people's minds and why was X, Y, or Z happening. And if this was being done, say, to send a message or, you know, to then I think you have a situation that is purely is inflammatory and is morally blameworthy. So you'd have to really, I think, find out what was going on, why that action was happening to really make the moral assessment. But I think it, at least at first blush, it looks clearly problematic.
And
ethically,
I mean,
troublesome.
One thing I want to reiterate, just because it came from our previous conversation, and this is something I've learned from Wayne Vaught. I mean, one of the most important moral virtues, I think, and this is something Aristotle says again and again and is repeated a lot by 19th century English philosophers, is this moral virtue of prudence,
mm-hmm.
of really trying to moderately exercise reason in an appropriate way, judging all of the factors. And it does seem like there was a failure of prudence,
mm-hmm.
In that situation by whoever the people were in charge. Mm-hmm. At least that much we could say was a kind of moral ineptitude, insensitivity.
And it's not just the incident itself. It points to a complete failure. With the relationships with the police department over a long period of time, the disparity between the backgrounds of the population and the police force, the relationship between that population and the police force. You know, you're seeing an incident, you're saying, is this problematic? Well, you have to understand the full context of it. And it's not just that there was this one incident that happened that in and of itself is ethically
right.
problematic. What you're seeing is a failure over a long period of time, and this highlights that fact. And that's why you're now seeing the federal government coming in. You're seeing in the investigations into not just the incident, but a profiling of arrest records, of traffic violations, of the various ways in which the police was interacting with that community.
Eric from Kansas City, Missouri, wants to talk about Al Sharpton's role here. Eric, good morning.
Oh, yeah, just briefly, I thought that his contribution was the best thing that happened, really, to the whole movement, because up and until he came to speak, if you notice, when he came to speak, he turned it into let's get out the vote. He turned it into there are questions of economic injustice in America, the haves and the have-nots, and he sort of aimed it in that direction and away from the sort of mindless let's string up the cop, you know what I mean, which is basically – really not very constructive, and the thing is the guy may not have done anything wrong. So I think Sharpton's contributions were really constructive.
That's interesting. And for a contrary view, Eric, Salvatore Lamastra, a political author and millennial who wrote this on The Blaze, it seems to me that liberals like the Reverend L. Sharpton only make it more difficult for African-Americans to succeed and receive justice. The Reverend seems to think that he can litigate controversies over wrongful deaths or murders using the media and his power grip as a civil rights activist and MSNBC anchor. L. Sharpton believes he's the judge and the jury. I cannot think of one instance, at least in my lifetime, where he has made a situation better. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think that the one thing we can certainly take away from it is that when we get everybody talking about social injustice, that's the only time that social injustice starts to change.
Yeah. Let's do this. Let's roll on to a final topic today just briefly, the new crackdown on college sexual assault, raising lots of questions about who should be held responsible for the handling of these cases. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill has a bill that's receiving bipartisan support that would require annual surveys of students about sexual violence and the reporting of the results, and it would require universities to designate and train confidential advisors for victims. My question, who should be held responsible for handling these cases? Why aren't these cases simply turned over to local police departments and colleges, Wayne Vaught, taken out of the equation altogether?
Well, in part because I think the universities are they are creating an environment. I mean, they are managing the environment, and especially you're talking about on-campus sexual assaults. And so there is a responsibility that a university has to try to create a safe environment to provide mechanisms for victims of crimes, and those crimes are going to exist. They're going to be on college campuses. You can't eliminate anytime you get people together. There are going to be these types of problems. I think there does need to be a very healthy relationship between law enforcement and the university in order to get the victims in the places where they need to go. I don't think it should be totally the university's responsibility, though. I don't think the university should be able to say, oh, this isn't our problem, because it is on our campus and there are ways in which law enforcement and the universities can work together.
But college campuses are set up to teach. They aren't set up to handle violent crimes like sexual assault.
Well, when you have dorms, when you have living quarters on the campuses, it's not just to teach. As a matter of fact, the university was talking about the living learning environment. You're merging together these two aspects of.
But why not have just the police handle the case? I mean, why does the university have to be there any more than, you know, you'd have to? Mm-hmm. If I live just off campus, why would I expect campus police to handle my case instead of Kansas City, Missouri police?
I mean, I guess it's a good question, other than the fact that I think that there is trust that the universities assume when students come and live on their campus, and they're putting out the word that we're creating a safe environment for your student, for the parent, for the student.
That part of the portfolio then becomes.
That's sort of an expectation that you have, and so I think that in doing that you take on some responsibility. Otherwise, universities could say, okay, we're not going to provide living environments on our campuses for that very reason, and you're sort of on your own.
I mean, this bill that Senator McCaskill is behind, it's a bipartisan bill. It would mandate new campus resources and support services for alleged victims. It would require schools to enter into agreements with local law enforcement over how to handle these things. And it would even institute penalties of up to 1% of the budgets of non-complying schools. We're talking big bucks here if schools aren't on board.
Yeah, well, that is a relevant point, right. And I'm glad you bring it up, Steve. I have a 19-year-old daughter who's at a small liberal arts college, and I do feel that her college has a responsibility. They do, in some sense, take on a bit of the parenting role when she goes off to school, and I do think they have an important responsibility to guarantee her. Do their best they can to guarantee their safety within the confounds of that new community of the college, mm-hmm. which is a slightly isolated community from the rest of the town in which she lives.
So this new bill from McCaskill, you think it's a good idea, if I'm hearing you right?
In some way, there are some things I would definitely say in favor of it. But what the point you just raised, which is, okay, we're asking colleges to do this, and we're going to penalize them financially if they don't. But is there also a promise in there that the federal government is going to help to finance what looks like it's going to be, require a lot of additional resources? I bet there isn't a guarantee that the federal government is going to provide that money. And so one of the things I think we as citizens need to think about is – if we are going to – I mean, universities across the nation, except for the various wealthiest schools, but especially state schools, are strapped for cash. They're losing money. They're having a desperate time. Tuitions are skyrocketing because we can't pay for schools. If we keep increasing the burdens on mm-hmm. colleges and universities without contributing to their budgets, as citizens, we're actually undermining our own educational system. And this has been the glory of the United States for a long, long time. And it could easily shift to India or China if we don't put some bucks into it.
And with that plug for higher education on the table, we're going to leave our conversation right there. I want to thank our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, and Clancy Martin, a professor of philosophy at UMKC. Gentlemen, always great to have you here.
Thanks so much
Appreciate
for having
it.
Us, Steve.